Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode.
Good afternoon, everybody, and a very warm welcome to the Melbourne Writers Festival. My name's Sally Warhaft. It's a great pleasure to be chairing this session. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that this event and this festival taking place on Wurundjeri land, and I'd like to acknowledge all the elders that may be here and past elders. It's a tremendous pleasure to be inviting these four wonderful authors with us today. Zena Cumston is a freelance writer, educator, curator and storyteller who's worked as a research fellow for the Clean Air Urban Landscapes Hub, where she explored stories about plant knowledge that were used to connect and educate community and support biodiversity. Michael Sean Fletcher is a Wurundjeri geographer and scientist and director of research at the Indigenous Knowledge Institute at Melbourne University. And his work focuses on the long-term interactions between humans, climate, environmental disturbances and vegetation. Leslie Head is Professor of Geography at Melbourne University and President of Australian Academy of the Humanities. She researches the cultural dimensions of environmental issues, including climate change, and her books include Hope and Grief in the Anthropocene. Together, the first three guests that I've introduced have co-written this wonderful book called Plants, Past, Present and Future. And, of course, that's where we get the title of the session today. And I was sort of saying backstage, it's unusual that you would have a co-authored book with three writers that is so seamless. It's a wonderful achievement. Congratulations. Bruce Pascoe is the author of the best-selling Dark Emu and more than 30 other books, including short story collections, academic texts, and his latest publication, which is co-authored with Vicky Sugaroglu, Loving Country, A Guide to Sacred Australia. And again, another really beautiful publication, and all our authors will be available to sign copies after this event. So please welcome our guests. Plants, Past, Present and Future. Now, this is not a conversation just about foliage and flowers and bush tucker. It's about connection. That was what I took away from this book more than, well, both books more than anything else. So I'd like to begin with this connection to country, in this case through plants, as a path to connection to each other, and to have each of you speak to that. And I might go to you first, Zena, because I think it was a line from one of your chapters that I thought of this.
I guess when I think about connection in terms of plants, I really think about the cultural specificity of our really diverse nations right across this place we now call Australia. And I guess one thing for me as a Barkindji person is that I have never felt more powerful and knowledgeable about my own people and history and culture as what I have as I've begun to understood the incredible innovation that we have undertaken to be able to stay on our country for the longest time imaginable, and how interconnected that is with plants. So the more that I understand about the plant usage of my own people, the more it's sort of helped me to feel connected and to feel really, really proud, and also to find pathways of sharing that connection with other people, because I think, you know, it's only relatively recently that we've started to understand the specificity of place and that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples are not a homogenous group in any way, shape or form. And I think the way that we've managed our countries over time is very much about that specificity of place and that connection that we've had with our own country. And so many amazing stories can be told about that through our plant usage.
Michael.
Yeah, I'll echo what Zina's just said. For me, plants are, well, they're the basis of everything, really, you know. And if you don't have a successful connection or relationship with plants, then you won't succeed. Now, they are the thing that converts solar energy into some utilisable form. So everything is utterly dependent on it. And I think the depth of time that mob have been on this place, developing really strong relationships to country, I think, through the use and not only manipulation, but just the reciprocity between plants and the world around them, the human and the non-human. But for me, the key role that the plants have played in our ability to thrive on a continent that people think is a desert. And you know, these kinds of terms that have born from a failure to connect with the plants and the place that this is. And I think that's, for me, the lens through plants and our ability to have that relationship is key to our success.
Leslie?
So just riffing off Michael there, we can extend further back in time as well to human evolution itself and the fact that all our bodies are, you know, we embody certain plant relationships in the way our bodies have evolved. So these are relationships that everybody likes to think about and needs to think about and understand, I think. It's, can I say a bit about connection between the authors? It's interesting you say it's seamless because the book was written during COVID lockdowns, and so we ended up with three different voices. Perhaps originally we thought it might be more single in its voice, but I think the braiding of the three different voices people have actually responded well to, so that's interesting.
Bruce?
I think the relationship between people and plants is pretty integral to how we have developed, as Leslie said. And I think of one of the plants we work with now, which is an Arthropodium, a vanilla lily, and there's a chocolate lily as well, many other lilies. We're only growing three of them at the moment. But it has grown up with people. And it is so reliant on people now that if you don't harvest it, it deteriorates. But if you lift it out of the ground and harvest some of the tubers and put it back in, that's what it likes. It is known that process, we could say 120,000 years or we could say 80,000 years. It wouldn't really matter. That's an incredible length of time for two people to live together, the plant and the person. And that relationship has created a change in the plant so that it looks forward to us interfering with it and harvesting it. And we have been changed by the plant because it's been such an important part of our diet. Plants were probably around 80% of the Aboriginal diet. And so the plant and the person has grown up together and we've changed each other. As Leslie said, it's such an important relationship that we've changed each other. And for us to be working with those plants on the farm and working with Aboriginal plants, not European plants, is such a significant thing. And the idea that Australians would eat Australian plants rather than English plants or South American plants shouldn't be an occasion for surprise. It should be natural. You know, why wouldn't we be eating the plants from this country that don't need any extra water? No fertiliser, no pesticide.
We have to notice the plants around us, of course, and come to know them and their uses. One of the things you really point out is that, and we often think of the settings for this as farms or bush, but the urban setting for plants that you've looked at, and that, you know, culture, belonging are erased in these urban environments. And I'm wondering, Zena, I'll get you to talk to this one and then you, Leslie, about looking in your own backyard in order to learn about this.
Yeah, I guess it sort of requires a huge amount of unpacking to think about the idea of erasure in urban areas, but I guess one thing I see as an Aboriginal woman who has pretty much always lived in urban areas is that there's very little opportunity for me to connect with plants, you know, that have been part of my culture for a really long time. And even though some of the plants from my own country actually grow here, in this place that we call Melbourne or Naam now, they're still not around. They've kind of been taken over by an aesthetic that is very much alien to what was once here. But I guess a big part of my work has been trying to help people to understand that there's no place anywhere in Australia from the perspective of our people that does not have belonging to one or more groups, and people who continue to speak for it today. There's everywhere. That's the situation. And I think more and more in urban areas, we're having more opportunities to see our plants and to think about our landscapes as country. And not completely, I guess, wiped out by the concrete and buildings that happen to be here now also. And I think we, as Aboriginal people, really need to have our plants and our cultural landscapes acknowledged more in urban areas, because it's really difficult not having your histories and belonging signposted anywhere around. There's a few public art things around. There's plaques nowadays, but very few. There's so much more we can do to make urban areas friendlier for our mobs. And I see plants as a really valuable way of enacting that, I guess, visual understanding of country in urban areas. And so there's lots of different gardens and things that are popping up, and lots of landscapers are really interested in using the plants that have been in that place for the longest time imaginable, but we still have a really long way to go in terms of acknowledging all of our landscapes as cultural landscapes and really enacting that belonging in a very visual way for all of our mobs and everyone else to know whose country they're on to and the plants that belong to it.
Leslie, can you talk about that as well? Because some of your research as well, you really focused on that in an urban backyard.
So I think from a European perspective, this whole discussion ties into the idea that nature is always found somewhere out in remote areas, somewhere out there, and a lot of work has gone on recently trying to unpack the ways that all the things that Europeans call nature are still very much part of the city, whether it's the bits of timber or cement or granite that helped build the building that you're sitting in, whether it's parts of your diet, or, as you say, whether it's things that are in your own backyard. And one of the examples we use in the book is the kumbungi, the bulrush, which is quite a widespread plant, but in the city it's typically found, you know, in the most neglected drain, the really poisoned, polluted drain or neglected wetland. So often it's a matter of changing the way you look at things and looking differently at the environment you're in.
Michael, you look at a natural archive. So one of the projects that you worked on was the Bolinbolin Billabong, which is it's in Bulleen, is yeah. That right? Can you tell us about that work?
Yeah, well, Bulleen gets its name from Bolin. Like it's it's really good. It's an interesting site because it's urban. You know, it's quasi sort of city, really. And it's the place that the Wurundjeri wanted to be relocated, you know, as Melbourne was expanding. But it was too desirable dairy land for that to happen, you know. And the reason it was desirable dairy land is because Aboriginal people made it that way. You know, there's more trees on that landscape now than there have ever been, you know. So it's this place where I think understanding the story there and the way that people connected to that place, the importance of it, and being able to reveal that story, and now that knowledge is hopefully being used to try and be a place where Wurundjeri get to re-establish their connection with country there through their actions, through plants, is a way to bring, I think, as Leslie's point, this perception, this... We walk around and everything we view is through a European lens. And look last night with the pageantry on the coronation, all this sort of... It's so alien to this place, you know. And Leslie's right. All the stuff that belongs to this place is considered rubbish, you know. It's in these little drains or it's scrubby bush and all this kind of pejorative language. And I think that Bowl and Billabong being so close, a place where people can visually see and connect with the history of this place and the way that Wurundjeri people cared for and managed this landscape, can be hopefully a way to break through that perception, you know. To And it's going to be... Has anyone been to Bowl and Billabong? Has anyone... Yeah?
It's connected to the river as well, isn't it? That's part of the story.
Yeah, so it's right now it's just messy. And Bruce and I were talking about this. Like, people see the broader landscape and they say, oh, that's lovely bush, but it's messy and it's unkempt and it's neglected, you know, and it's unhealthy. And we've seen how dangerous that can be in the catastrophic fires through neglecting our role and our connection, our obligation to country to look after it. And Boland's a perfect representation of that. You talk to people walking through and they're like, oh, it's lovely bush. But it's unkempt, you know. It needs to be looked after. And there's a beautiful story that's come out of that Billabong, which I elucidate in the book, of how Wurundjeri actively made that landscape. And it dispels a whole lot of myths. It dispels myths that Aboriginal people, just like David Horton, in his book, A Pure State of Nature, who said, oh, Aboriginal people had no discernible influence on the landscape whatsoever. Well, this story proves unequivocally that Aboriginal people changed this landscape and wrapped it into their economy, yeah? And that's repeated time and time again. So it shows that through that connection with place and through the lens of plants, by manipulating the landscape, caring for it, loving it, you ended up with this really diverse... healthy place that's now descended into a mess. And you go to the sediments now, they're disgusting. You pull this core out, it stinks. But then you go down a bit deeper in time and everything starts to be healthy again. The mud looks really nice and all this. So it's a perfect place, I think, to bring the rest of society along and show how it is that you can look after country and people don't have to think it's out in the bush. You know, it's right there in one of the world's most livable cities, you know. And I think, I don't know if you're involved in it, Bruce, but they do burning in Adelaide now, you know. Like, you know, I've got this dream, you know, Martin Luther King, I have a dream. Well, instead of mowing our lawns, why aren't we getting out there and burning them, you know? Like, you know, when you're driving on the freeway and there's all that grass and you see these mowers and they go around and they miss it because the big mower can't get in there and it looks terrible. Why aren't we in there just burning it? The fire will drip right into the, you know. But we're clinging on to these tropes and these things that just don't succeed. And I think Boland's a really good place where we can bring that together.
This is a great time to start talking about God, which we saw a lot of yesterday. I didn't. I was busy. apparently the world is now enamoured of a princess in a green dress. I don't know what she's princess of, but her job was to hold a sword, which is apparently fairly difficult, like this or like this. And, you know, so now the world is going to be fascinated by another royal for a little period of time, but a sword. You know, what's that saying about that culture, the sword, an instrument to stab people through the guts, chop off their heads, And I want Australia to start looking at the philosophy of this country. It's the philosophy that is behind your living here now. It's in the country, that philosophy still. And it's a philosophy where people were dealing with the same animal, the human, but organising those humans in a really different way. And with deep connection to country, not just being unwitting participants in country, but managing country, changing country, as Michael said. We have to acknowledge that Aboriginal people were active in changing the plant structure of this country, but through philosophy, not through wood chips to Japan, but through philosophy, and a philosophy which eschewed war. And I'd like a hot dinner and a beer for every time I've said it in the last 20 years, but I get almost no reaction from that. A society without war, and yet it's probably one of the most fundamental things in human philosophy that we need to address. Imagine a group of people who run their society without war. And I really want our children, black and white, to think about a world like that. Is it possible? Yeah, it's possible. Because it was managed here for 120,000 years, whatever number you like to use, and nowhere else. And this is your country. This is Australia. It's here. And that attitude to each other transferred itself to country as well, because in my culture, we begin conversations and end them with the phrase through the mother, or Nachatang Dunga, or Binyajanal, or Birang Nujan. It's about the woman looking after Mother Earth. That's what it essentially means. And so this philosophy of managing people wasn't just political. It was geographic and botanical as well. And it's a fully rounded of philosophy, and I'm begging Australia to have a close look at it, to urge our children to think of a world without war, because we allow our children to play war because we think that's the way human life progresses. And if human life can only progress through war, what a sad feature that is. I think it's really important days, and we work together a fair bit because we talk about plants and this country. But we need to, as a country, look at this example of human behaviour that I think could be an exemplar in a world of strife and a world of environmental decay, that this thinking of Earth as the mother is such an important philosophical statement. And you can see I wind myself up like a Bourke Street tram. I'll stop there.
You won't, but I might narrow it down for you for this next, thinking about what you've just said, that the philosophy gets simplified and oversimplified. And so for something like plant knowledge, it then becomes bush tucker. And I don't know, you talk about the idea of, that it becomes a garnish, that Indigenous plant knowledge turns into bush tucker, which becomes a garnish, which is something that's not essential. It's a nice addition to what we already have. Bruce, you point out that, the fixation on witchetty grubs you know, as a as sort of something kind of a bit disgusting or and not abundant, that there's a that actually the way Indigenous knowledge is still very much thought about in relation to plants is so far away from the philosophy you describe. Would you like to speak to that?
Well, I think it's just colonial rule number one. If you want to take someone's country, show those people that you take it from no respect at all. In fact, try and indicate that they're not really humans. And if you admit that they are identical in physiology to yourselves, then try to denigrate their brain or their morality. And so if you do that, then you cannot accept anything that those people have done. So that's why when Europeans were looking for a protein source, they turned away from the kangaroo to the bullock and the sheep, and almost overnight destroying the country wherever those beasts roamed, and turning away from the manyang or the vanilla lily for the inferior carrot and radish and parsnip as a deliberate colonial preference. Obviously, Europeans would like to eat the things that they were familiar with, but where was the curiosity for these other plants? And in accepting those plants, the colonial had to admit the land was stolen. But if you reject the kangaroo and the manyang, then you can take the country with a clear conscience. We have to get over that. We're here now. You know, this blend of people in this audience probably not going to change much over the next 100 years. If we don't learn to relate to each other, we'll continue to destroy the earth and to live an impoverished philosophic life. So I think we need to understand what colonialism has done to us and to everyone. And we can do something about it. I don't want this country to become America. You know, this is my country. And we are dangerously close to adopting the same way of controlling populations as America has done, and it's unhealthy. And there is a healthy way for humans to relate to each other and to the earth.
The heart of the book, Plants, Past, Present and Future, are, I think, three chapters on specific plants. Kumbungi, is that how? Kumbungi, yam, and spinifex, and also the condoms, this chapter as well. And if we just stay with Kumbungi as a... You describe it as a... you know, that it could be a survivalist's best chance as a famine food. This remarkable staple that we've reduced to a sort of weed, I suppose, people who live around it. Can you tell us about that plant?
Sure. But first to say that, of course, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of plants that Aboriginal people knew and lived with all over the continent. And so one of the challenges in writing a book about called Plants was you can't possibly be comprehensive, so you have to pick a few examples. So it's Kumbungi, the bulrush. You all would have seen it, even if you didn't kind of recognise it. It has a rhizome, a horizontal tuber, which is actually not the most efficient way to get carbohydrates. So some of the ethnographic records say that it was only used in particularly difficult times. So when conditions were less difficult in the southeast, for example, people would have been eating a lot more of Murnong and things that, that Bruce is growing at the moment. But it is a very... it's a very resilient plant. It responds well to fire. It's a wetland plant, so if you can imagine burning back in a wetland at particular seasons. Well, I could go on and on. There's a whole chapter there. Mm. But I, for me, it's kind of a metaphor as well of the resilience that we'll need in the future, the different kind of thinking we'll need in the future, and that we need under a kind of climate-changed future as well. But it's completely ignored as even a potential food source.
And it's delicious.
Yeah, and actually on my country, people used it so much that a lot of our ancestors, the remains that have had to be repatriated in the women's mouths, the relationship to that plant is inscribed still in their bodies thousands of years later. The teeth are ground right down because we would chew the fibre, which was like we'd eat the potato and then we'd chew the fibre to make most of our nets and our technologies because it's so strong. So Uncle Badger Bates, who's a Barkindji elder, told me that lots of the ancestors that he's had to look after, he can see in the women their teeth worn right down, so that relationship's inscribed in our bodies.
And some of those nets are hundreds of metres long, weren't they?
Yeah, there's one at the South Australian Museum from my country, which is in Western New South Wales. That's 180 metres long and it's made from Kumbungi.
We missed so much of learning this knowledge because of observation bias, which you write about. Michael, can you tell us about that and about what is the way in for this to not be overlooked, these plants that serve this country perfectly?
Yeah, as Bruce has hinted, it requires a big philosophical shift. Modern society is just extractive and exploitative, you know, like it's take. And I think you're seeing the results of that. We're getting salinized soils, we're getting fires, we're getting, you know, all this sort of catastrophic, the fish deaths, all these kind of things just from that, because it's all take, there's no give. And I think the lens that was brought in, you see what you want to see, you know, you bring in your ideas, you ask questions, it dictates the kind of answers you'll get back. You know, I think what we actually need to do is sit down with people like Uncle Badge and other people and try and view the world from a different perspective, you know, having a look around. I just kept thinking when Bruce was talking, you have to dispel this myth constantly. People just think Aboriginal people walking around and just shit fell on our lap. Oh, there's a duck. You beauty, you know. Oh, I need to build a hut. There'll be a tree over there, you know. Like, it'll happen, you know. Some of the houses and huts that were built were amazing construction, you know, that would have required forestry, keeping trees at the right size. You know, just wander around and, you know, there's this idea that Aboriginal people just wandered. Oh, there's a tree, I'll just pick that up and, you know, next thing I'll collect enough of them to build my hut. You know, there's this reluctance and it's a dehumanisation that Bruce sort of touched on. Inability to set up. This place was incredibly managed. You know, there were crops over there for plants for building. You know, there were crops over there. You don't have to walk all over the countryside if you're doing something smart. And then you go, there's there. And you can have everything at your hands. Well, what we've come in and we've gone, okay, it's got to be wheat, it's got to be rice, it's got to be. I mean, we grow cotton on this continent. I mean, talk about the most unsustainable plant on one of the driest continents on earth. So we need, not only for the health of the country, but for ourselves, is to open our eyes and look around. And I think you've done that amazing book, you know, that Victorian plants that were, you know, you walk along the street and there's something you can eat and use, not as a garnish. You know, there is so much out there, but all we see are cows, sheep, wheat, you know, these kinds of, and we just ignore everything else. And it's, there's just so much out there, but we can't unlock it with the eyes that we have now. So what we're doing at the university is trying to bring other eyes in, you know, because it's too late. Once someone's gone and done a PhD, they're done. They're Western, you know, like don't anyone who doesn't have a PhD come in, you know, like this kind of, how can we view this differently? And then suddenly it's like an object in a room, right, a dark room, and you shine a light on it, right? You don't know what the whole object looks like. You know what your light's shining, you know, what's around the back of that, and what's on the other side of the moon, that kind of stuff. It's that there's a whole universe out there that we just do not look at, you know, and we have this conceit, especially I'm working in one of the most conceited places on earth, the Ivory Tower, you know, like we know everything. Well, no, we know this, you know, and we fail to look at it, even slightly ajar, and you'll just see all these things pop up, I think.
I think the architecture of our perception is doing us all harm in lots of ways, because I think everyone would agree none of us are learning enough about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and culture in our schools, in our universities, in our workplaces. And people are really hungry to understand more and to be more respectful and for that to come from a really solid base. And I think what we're all sort of talking about is that lens that you can put on things. Once you start to know a little bit about something, it opens up a whole other world. And really it's up to each of us individually, because we aren't in our systems at the moment, in our schools and everywhere else, doing enough, in my opinion. What my kids are learning is wonderful, but it's not that different to what I learnt 43 years ago when I was 5 years old starting school. And I think for all of us, that architecture of our perception is holding us back in terms of being able to access some of the solutions that we're going to need moving forward. We have to find different ways of seeing that actually are underpinned by an understanding of country as mother, as Uncle Bruce was talking about, and the need for reciprocity. We are extracting and taking all the time because we live in a capitalist system and a colonial system still. Colonisation is not something in the past. It's an ongoing structure, and that's why our people are still begging for their lives over intercoms. These things are happening today. And if each of us can find a way of changing the architecture of our perception through educating ourselves, I feel like we're going to be able to go a lot faster to where we need to.
And so, to touch on that, the school, I think, is an important one, and talking about connection. This weird sort of cartoon in my head, but it's reality, is that we send our kids to a school, we lock them in a room and teach them about the outside world. It's that ridiculous, you know? And not only the outside world, we teach them about giraffes and, you know, I'm sure they're wonderful and they're beautiful. Why aren't our kids out there with their feet in the dirt? You know, why are they learning rudimentary maths with rocks or leaves and stuff like that? Why are we locking ourselves in rooms, disconnecting, and then trying to connect with this? All you're doing is you're just creating disconnection, you know, like you're not allowing that to happen. So it starts that deep with the kids, I reckon.
Something I've noticed in the last few years, it used to be when we're discussing the big problems of Australia and the world that people would, you know, unleash their misery in a talk forum or a book. But then they'd always conclude in a kind of neat little sentence or paragraph towards the end of about, you know, what do you have hope? Well, the young. I have hope in the young. I've noticed a change recently. I have hope in Indigenous knowledge. And I wonder if that is annoying, given that that knowledge is hardly recognised in what you're saying today, and certainly not compensated. And in fact, when you write about bush food and the economy of the of that industry, I think it's 1% that is actually going to Indigenous people. So I just, Bruce, maybe you can tell us how you feel about Indigenous people along with everything else they're expected to do. They now have to, you know, save everyone from ourselves.
Well, I'm hoping there are some capitalists in the room because part of what I want to talk about today is forestry. And we are using our forests in the least efficient financial management that you can possibly do by sending our prime forest to Japan to as a slurry of wood pulp to be made into paper, which we re-import as McDonald's wrappers. And it is the it's really lowbrow capitalism, and if capitalists really got involved, we would have we'd make more money out of the forest, but we'd also have a better forest. In Far East Gippsland, the forestry operation that created all that wood pulp was made up of young trees that were so close to each other that as soon as the fire was introduced to the forest, it completely destroyed the forest. There are parts of that forest where there's not a stick left, where they're just piles of white ash. It looked like snow immediately after the fire. And that's because we've allowed the public forest to be used in the least economically beneficial way. And it's the same with our foods as well. We think we've been indoctrinated with the idea that industrial agriculture is the way forward. Industrial agriculture is the only way to get flour. Industrial agriculture is the only way to get fruit and vegetables, when the Aboriginal forest was so complex. And we're encouraged to think that complexity is the enemy. But complexity is the structure in the forest that our old people designed. And they designed it that way so that the these plants could interconnect with each other. The mycorrhizal fungus was still there because superphosphate wasn't being spread. That all of these things were in contact with each other. There's that wonderful book, I can't remember its name now, but it talks about mycorrhizal fungi under the ground connecting everything together. And that's the old way, the old forest that the people in Australia were able to design. And if we could go back to those days, then we'd have a much healthier land, we'd have a much healthier population. But it just means thinking differently about who we are and the country where we live, and being gentler on the land. And capitalists can do this. We can changing capitalism to look after the earth is not communism. It's not a corollary. It has just changed capitalism. Capitalism has changed many, many times. Perhaps the dead end street of capitalism was the cotton mill, and we're still suffering from that idea that a rich man could imprison and enslave a whole population to his will. And that shouldn't be the heart of communism, heart of capitalism. And it shouldn't be the heart of communism either. Remember the Aral Sea and what cotton farming by communists did to the Aral Sea. These things are not opposites. They can be the same thing, and the people's will can generate a much kinder world. And Leslie talking about kumbungi before, this is a really important plant. It's a good food plant, it's a great fibre plant, it's a great water filter. And Bob Massey, Charles Massey, wrote a book called The Cry of the Reed Warbler. The reed warbler lives in kumbungi. And to call a book The Cry of the Reed Warbler is such a romantic thing. But we should have romance in our commerce. We should have philosophy in our commerce and in our daily life. And the kumbungi, we spend in Australia millions of dollars, literally millions of dollars, dredging this plant out of our irrigation channels. We could close off those channels, put the kumbungi in, let the waterway restore itself, and we would eat well and make a lot of money. It's up here that has to change, not the ground. As soon as we change our way of looking at the world, the change will be incredible. Are we capable of doing it? Well, we did it once before.
If you would like to ask a question for someone from our panel, you can put your hand up and someone will deliver you a microphone. You put your hand right up, though, if you'd like to. Somebody here? Yep, keep your hand up. That's it. Great.
Thank you for a fascinating conversation between you all. And hi to Bruce. Good to see you again. Most of the talk has been on using plants as food. The other side is that, and I hope, by the way, that the food that you're talking about and the plants that you're talking about would give us a balanced diet. But I'd like to talk about the thought that there would have to be some pharmaceutical plants. And I'm wondering if you've found many of those and in what changes go with what different geographical areas.
The book, you do write about medicinal use. Who wants to jump in on that? And Bruce can talk as well, but in your book, who is it that...
I wrote a little bit about it in the book. It's definitely not an area that I would say that I know a lot about. But, again, the medicinal value of plants in terms of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's knowledge is very much still under-resourced. And there have been many problems with biodiscovery in Australia, and we actually don't have yet any overarching laws that protect the knowledge that's associated with the medicinal use of plants and all other uses also. And so a lot of pharmaceutical companies have been driving much of the research that's been going into our plant usage, and that's a bit scary because pharmaceutical companies are not looking to give correct benefit or intellectual and cultural property rights to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So we have an incredible array of plants that have medicinal value that are still not being understood and recognised here in Australia today, because we know from our own oral histories, but also from all of the people who came here when Australia was invaded, that our people were extremely fit, strong and healthy. And that was to do with our knowledge of plants, to me, the more that I understand. And we have been using medicines from plants forever, and we barely use them today. But pharmaceutical companies have patented and taken a lot of the knowledge of Australia's First Peoples from the very beginning of invasion, and they're still doing it today. And we have massive problems here with that bioprospecting that's going on, and the fact that we're not protecting ourselves, and we're definitely not giving benefit to the communities from which this knowledge has emanated and is held.
Bruce, I mean, you've talked repeatedly today that it's not one thing; it's a philosophy. It's not just food; it's agriculture, it's economy, it's philosophy. Is there anything you'd like to add?
It's not common for me to make appeals to capitalists, but I am, because we do, you know, we're not going to change our economic system overnight, but we have to change our attitude to plants. They're not commodities. They have their own rights and their own personalities. And it's really important that we're genuine in reducing the amount of money that is extracted. Michael used the word extraction before. That not treating the country like a mine, but also not treating it as a mine for white people. You know, 99% of all the money out of Aboriginal food goes to non-Aboriginal people. And 1% goes to Aboriginal people. We can change that by thinking differently about how we apply capitalism. And we run a company called Black Duck Foods, and we spend an inordinate amount of our time defending ourselves from non-Aboriginal predators, people who want to piggyback on the knowledge and give nothing back. In fact, challenge us in courts. No, this is our knowledge, not the knowledge of this country. That's disappointing. So this is an appeal to capitalists to make money, make sufficient money to make sure your child is the best the bike in the street, if you must, but make sure that the sharing is greater, that all people can benefit from the country, from these plants. That seems a bit scatological to me, but I hope it makes some sense.
Anybody? Back there. Thanks.
My question is, how can non-Indigenous Australians engage with the potential of these plants and the traditional land management practices without it perpetuating the cultural appropriation that has been prevalent in Australia?
Michael, would you like to regard that one?
Yeah, people always ask this. Yeah, it's tricky, hey? I mean, Bruce has already suggested you could make choices about where you buy things and what you do and where that money trail is going, if you like, you know, like not just going for the cheapest or going for your, what is it, Wattle Seed Cakes or something like that that is run by a non-Aboriginal organisation, so you can be smarter with your choices. But I think we have to realise we're now sharing this place, you know. Aboriginal people are very welcoming and open if you sit down and listen and talk. You know, it's, we get wary when people say, oh, you know, what's the secret or what's the this or how can I take that, you know, like, or you know, can you just manage that forest with fire and, you know, that's still just extractive, you know. It's not, it's single use. You have a purpose rather than sitting down and developing a genuine connection and understanding. And I think if you sit down and look anyone in the eye and treat them with respect and listen to their journey and work with them, they'll be happy to share, you know, and share in the spoils. I think it's, a lot of it's just the way that we approach. If you're going in wanting something specific, you're already appropriating, I think. So if you're going down, sit down, listen and just go on the journey, then most people will be willing to hold your hand and take you there. So for me, it's about the conversation and respect.
And there's so much research that still needs to be done and, you know, there's, we need to be together in that. On my country, we call it Naracha, which I've got a show opening next week, which is all about this togetherness and also about plant knowledge. So come along to that at Bunjil Place. But with that Naracha idea, it's about, you know, we have to black and white, all of us together, work out the way forward. And it's all about reciprocal, respectful relationships, because all I see around me is extractive attitudes about what can be taken, what can be used. And I see it in language all the time, especially when people are talking about Indigenous knowledge, they can't help but use these words that sound like mining. We have to start thinking about it in terms of empowering Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities through their own self-determination and what role other people have in that. And there's so many different things that non-Aboriginal people can do to help to empower communities, and it's just about that understanding of reciprocity. So often people come to me with projects that don't include any reciprocity at all, and they cannot see how one-sided it is. They see their own really great idea and that it's doing something great from their perspective, but they have not once considered how that might be reciprocal in terms of having benefit for the mob that they're talking about, you know, coming together with. So I think we all have a place in making things better, but it's fundamental to me is that reciprocity.
One more. Got time for one last question. Great.
So I've been looking at a lot of resources, and I've gotten to sort of almost the university level of, you know, where we're engaging in sort of first or second year studies, might be, Michael, if you're familiar with that kind of level. Probably all of you are. But then I run into the problem where all the information is in formats that very rightly are not written down. If they want to be authentic, they're not written down. The knowledge that's shared is from second or third hand resources. I'm just wondering how someone who isn't able to access country, to access an elder to sit down with and give personal knowledge, is there a good way for someone to broaden their knowledge and make sure they're being respectful about it while also needing something written down?
Excuse me, Bruce.
Can read this book.
I didn't hear the question.
I can answer that one if you like, yeah. So I think for me, I always try and find sources that come direct from my people. So for such a long time, we had different groups, anthropologists, all sorts of different people who basically got first-hand knowledge from community members and then translated it. And that translation to me is where this lens gets put on that is quite different. And it kind of, to me, it mucks up the information a little bit. But having said that, all sources have their value. And we've really seen that in language revival that's happened and is happening right across Australia at the moment. There's colonial records, there's things from linguists who came here, church people also who wrote books, and then there's living knowledge in communities. And so to me it's about putting lots of different sources together. And so I think the more that you can try and find things written directly by community members, which today is happening more and more, the better your own lens will develop in terms of hearing straight from the source. And of course, you know, we're all different and we all have diverse views. But I think that's one thing that's been a massive improvement nowadays is that we are publishing our own books. We are speaking a lot for ourselves. There's not so much mediation going on. So I hope that you'll find what you need through just looking really hard for things that come from us, written by us, and for us and for everyone.
And that's exactly right. And there's also the realisation we live in a society now where everything's commodified and everything's up for grabs. Sometimes you're just not going to find out. And sometimes you may, it might be unfortunate, but you have to go and look an elder in the eye, or you have to go and, otherwise it's just not available to you, you know. And there's this expectation in society that if I want, I can have, you know, and it should, and it, even now, I mean, it's too ridiculous, just download it, you know, and it should all be there. But you've got to earn the rights to knowledge. You've got to earn the right to understanding. And I think that sometimes you have to understand that some knowledge is available to you and some isn't, and some needs to be earned. And that's a journey, you know. So I think we have to get away from that kind of on-demand, what is it, streaming knowledge, you know, like it's, you know, it's...
And Leslie, you're absolutely right. You can buy this book and... You can probably get it autographed by the writers as well. You've got to do your homework, don't you? You've got to see what's already right in front of you. And in fact, that's another theme in both these books is look.
Well, also one of the things we tried to do in the book was bring different types of evidence into conversation with each other. So there is archaeology, there's a bit of anthropology, there's historical sources, there's oral history. So they all have different perspectives, and in some ways the combination of those things is what the story is.
Our time is up. It's just flown by. I want to thank you, Leslie, Bruce, Zena and Michael. It's been really terrific to read the work and to meet you all and have you talking about it today. Thank you. You've been a wonderful audience. Have a great rest of the Writers' Festival.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.